Hello and welcome back to Big Mouth, the faulty towers of pop criticism, where we run our fingers around the skirting boards of rock and the shower curtains of roll in search of dust, dandruff and debauchery. I'm Andrew Harrison.
And I'm Sian Pattenden, the sleek and uncompromising Sybil to Andrew's rampageous and wayward Basil Fawlty. This week, we've got the surprisingly tender autobiography of Scissor Sisters frontman Jake Shears, Will Boys Keep Swinging, Do What It Says on the Tin, and Steven Soderbergh's new horror movie in Unsane, not Insane, shot on an iPhone and set in a mental hospital. What's not to love?
Plus, we're going to be looking at the great Britpop Come Down album, This Is Hardcore by Pulp, which is 20 years old this week. Yes, we all feel ancient. Does it still sound as bleak as it did when it came out, or is it the undersung masterpiece of 90s pop? And we're going to be returning to a Big Mouth classic, the album that our guests like, but nobody else does. So who are those guests, I hear you ask? Linda Marek is a film writer for Screen Words, The Jewish Chronicle, Hey You Guys, and Empire Magazine. She's a Big Mouth regular and a fan of intelligent sci-fi. Hello, Linda, how are you?
I'm fine, how are you?
I'm all right, not good bad. It's a, on the intelligent sci-fi front. It's a pity it weren't here last week when we did Annihilation, yeah, which has gone straight to Netflix. What's your hot take? Give us your hot take.
I absolutely loved it. I thought it was fantastic. It's clever. I mean, I was so disappointed that Paramount didn't have the balls to put it on a big screen before it went straight to Netflix. And I think what happened is they probably screen tested it to a mainstream audience who just didn't get it. I just thought it was very intelligent, thought-provoking, brilliantly done, and it just, I absolutely loved it. It was perfect, perfectly done.
And it seems to be the victim of this kind of squabble at the heights of the company where, you know, all data is saying intelligent sci-fi, people really like it. You know, Arrival, Interstellar, and so
absolutely.
On. And this one seemed to be too clever.
Well, I think with all things, it depends who you screen test it to. I mean, who did they want to be selling this to? I think Alex Garland has shown with Ex Machina that he can get people in.
Yeah.
And I think people would have watched this. People would have gone. I think, having five female leads, maybe that scared them a bit. I don't know.
Women, I think it's so silly. Frightening.
I think it's just so silly. I think they should have showed it to
and
us.
And there were four of them as well, which is four times as frightening.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we can deal with gigantic albino alligators with additional teeth, but women. I mean, are you insane? What are your top tips for what's coming out in the movies that we ought to be paying attention to in the next couple of weeks?
Okay. So my first choice would be Custody or Jusqu'à la Garde, which is a French. Mm-hmm. It's directed by Xavier Legrand, and it's a film about a broken marriage, but it's not like Kramer versus Kramer. It's a lot more sort of, it's a custody battle that goes wrong and over a little boy, and it's absolutely beautiful. It's really, it's kind of between thriller and horror, but it's really realistic. It's beautifully done as well.
We'll keep an eye out for that one.
Okay. Also with us this week, we have Kate Hutchinson, who writes for The Guardian, The Observer, Mix Mag, and anyone else you'll have her. She's the erstwhile editor of The Guardian Guide and clubbing editor of Time Out. Yay!
It's a terrible, terrible job. It was awful.
You now have a monthly show on Worldwide FM, apparently, where you explore the radical outermost limits of international pop. Hello, Kate.
I do. Hi. Mm. I'm going to nick that, actually, for my bio. You put it much better than I ever could.
It's our business.
What's on this week's show, then?
Well, actually, this week's show, I have got my old editor, Dave Swindells, who is really, he used to work at Time Out London. He was the clubbing editor before I was for about 20-odd years. And he really showed me the ropes. And he's got some great stories. He was basically one of the first photographers and journalists on the front line of Acid House when all that happened. And of course, this year is 30 years since the second Summer of Love.
Oh,
now, it is only March.
30, yeah.
But apparently, I'm getting in there early because apparently...
It's the spring of love.
It's the spring before the Summer of Love. And actually, all the big clubs like Shoom and Paul Oakenfold Sin, which was in Soho, they actually started kicking off in April. So I thought, I've got an April guest already, so why don't I just get Dave in? And Giles Peterson is really, I mean, whenever you mention Dave Swindell's name, he gets all giddy with glee, because there was a time when if you were putting on clubs in London, Dave was the sort of the gatekeeper, really. If you didn't get your club listed by Dave, you didn't get, not as many people.
He was the Mark Zuckerberg of rave.
This is pre-Facebook, pre-social media, obviously. So, I mean, it was Time Out really meant something back in those days.
And you had to pay for it as well. Then,
you had
you?
To pay
so
for
So you
it.
Invested your money, you needed the facts and the info.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's crazy to think now, but the clubbing pages were... you know, about, there was about six pages worth of listings. That's a lot of club nights. That's a lot of choice.
It was off your Facebook. And I believe you've also got Kid Bachelor from Bang the Party coming on as well.
Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah.
I love Bang the Party. They were like the great British house acid thing that kind of went under the radar, weren't they?
Fantastic, exactly. So I think, you know, possibly for my generation, we hear about the story of Acid House and it's just four white blokes that went to Ibiza and came back and brought, you know, brought back ecstasy and blah, 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 and then Acid House was born. And actually the real story is that it's a lot more diverse than that. There are a lot more key people involved, and Kid Bachelor is one of them whose stories I can't wait to hear.
Excellent, fantastic. And that's, where can we hear this?
On Worldwide FM.
Mm-hmm. And it's available on listening. Is it available on a Listen Again thing?
Yeah, you can go on their website and they archive all of the shows via Mixcloud, I think. So you can just go on worldwidefm.net.
Fantastic.
Great. That sounds splendid. We'll get started after this brief message from Andrew.
As regular listeners know, we're putting out a Geldof-style plea to you to help cover the expenses on this show via the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Not send us the feckin' money, but simply buy us a feckin' pint once a month, or more specifically, give us the virtual equivalent of the price of a pint. Because much as we love doing Big Mouth, these studio costs won't pay themselves. Simply a fiver a month from just 120 listeners will cover all of our studio costs and enable Big Mouth to carry on in rude health. Yes, that's what a pint costs down here in the metropolitan bubble. We're aiming to raise £600 a month, and we're already a bit over a third of the way there. When we reach our target, we can start recording extra bits each week just for our lovely Patreon backers. Go to patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more, or the links at the top of the Big Mouth Facebook page. All we're saying is buy us a pint. Okay, then let's get started with a book, specifically Boys Keep Swinging, the autobiography of Jake Shears, frontman with queer pop disco ensemble, The Scissor Sisters. Born in Arizona and growing up in the Pacific Northwest, young Jason Sellards has future gay pop star written all over him from an early age. He sings, he dances, he performs. He has a great fondness for his He-Man action figure, and he suffers the private agonies of the kid who knows he's different. You might imagine that becoming a huge pop star might then be the perfect revenge. Doesn't quite work out like that. What do we make of the book? We're going to find out after this. Here are The Scissor Sisters with Filthy Gorgeous. Scissor Sisters with Filthy / Gorgeous. And we're talking about Jake Shears' autobiography, Boys Keep Swinging. I found this a right rollicking read. Kate, what did you make of this?
Yeah, it was witty, it was zippy, it had some wonderful, loads of wonderful phrasing, lots of colourful, vibrant prose in there, I thought. I love it in the beginning where he talks about, as a young boy, he was haunting the all corners of my house like a jazzy poltergeist, he said.
Yes, jazzy poltergeist.
But what I really loved about this is the moments where he talks about New York clubbing in the early 2000s. Because for the first time, along with the book that came out last year, Meet Me in the Bathroom, I really felt like this was finally an era I can be nostalgic about. I caught the tail end of this. He talks about clubs like Nag 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 in London at the Ghetto, which I remember going to. He talks about DJs like Larry T, who quote unquote invented Electro Clash, who I also know. So there's lots of characters kind of flying into it that I recognised, club nights that I recognise, characters like Justin Bond, the fabulous drag queen or drag performer in New York. And it felt like, you know that film Short Bus that came out that had Justin Bond in it, where it had this wonderful club called Short Bus? It felt like he was describing that New York / that London.
It's funny, I mean, the Scissor Sisters sort of seem to have, they were so huge, so, you know, they just completely dominated, what was it, 2004 or 5?
Yeah. Around that time,
Played Glastonbury twice on one day, they were absolutely everywhere, and they looked like the return of Roxy Music, only different and better. And then, I suppose this book is the story of how they get to the top and then realise how very, very difficult it's going to be to go on.
I think it's very rare that you read that in a book where he talks about being at the Brits and scooping, because he was Scoop Awards, three awards, and just feeling really, really depressed. And he said, if you look at the video footage of it, I just look like a broken man because I know it's only downhill from there. Yeah. Yeah. Now, that's really revealing. Most people think, well, I can ride this for a few more years. It's fantastic. I'm going to go and take loads of drugs and see lots of people. He just thinks this is the end. And the honesty of that coming out, I thought that was remarkable, whereas some of the club bits, I didn't know some of the names. Yeah. So to me, it's like just a roll call of names and I wasn't there.
Well, it is. It's an enormously hedonistic book until he becomes enormous.
He does enjoy himself, doesn't he?
Yeah. There's a lot of shagging. Mm. But it's kind of, it's also rather charming and innocent. And he just seems like a really nice bloke who's like finally getting to be the person that he wanted to be. And when fame kicks in, it all becomes rather more horrible.
The fact that he didn't buy into the fame just shows how clever he was as well. Mm. He's a very intelligent performer as well. And he's, I think, everyone thought he was going to be a writer at one point and then went on to be a pop star, as it were. But I think what just shows the fact that he didn't buy into the whole. Of course, he enjoyed himself, but when he knew that this wasn't going to go on forever. I think I like that about him.
See, I think there's a slight. I'm not saying that this book isn't very candid and revealing. It is, but I think there's a. I don't know whether he's being entirely off, honest with himself about a lot of the things in the book. When a few things, details seem to be revealing to me, like when he talks about the dynamics of Scissor Sisters. I mean, the way he regards animatronic in the book was quite shocking to me. I mean, clearly. Something's gone wrong with their relationship.
I was surprised at that. Yeah, it's not the relationship that you kind of think they've got from the outside. Yeah.
Totally. They're not best buddies, are they? They seem to have had some massive falling out.
Exactly. And it would have been great to have a bit more, I guess, some more juicy details on
that. Yes, because there's points towards the end where he says, well, I was a bit of a diva. I had all these arguments with people. Someone overhears an argument between him and Scott when they're writing music. And I've never seen people get at each other like that. I don't know how you survived that. Mm-hmm. And you don't get that glimpse. He's quite, you know, tepid almost in a way in some of these points.
There's something missing. He's holding back. Mm. I do think that what is interesting about it is that, you know, you look at the Scissor Sisters, he was this kind of, you know, flouncing, beglittered, sequined kind of, you know, diva, whatever you want to call him, kind of, you know, Duracell bunny when he performed. Yeah. Mm. And actually, he talks about being quite uncomfortable with his sexuality all the way through. He didn't really hold down a relationship in the way that you know, perhaps might have expected. It seemed like he wasn't quite ever comfortable with his experiences, perhaps. And I thought that was really curious and interesting.
It kind of, it's like the exhibitionism and the sort of manic creativity and the endless hammering away at trying to get to a dream that he's not sure what it is.
Yes, exactly.
Seems to be filling in for something.
Yeah.
But I think that's I think that's admirable that a person can talk about
Absolutely.
That. Mm. The only bit where I lost interest is when they're actually enormous and suddenly they're hanging out with Elton and David.
Oh, I like those bits.
And you know, Michael Stipe and his boyfriend and Bono's giving him the talk. And
I know, but he's so withering about Bono.
I hate it when
he gives him the fame talk and he says, I realise that Bono gives everyone this talk.
Yeah. But that's like, you know, it's not just the fact that, you know, when you're a band like this, because, you know, he's experiencing it for the first and only time. But we're journalists and we've talked to people about this and we realise that
they all go
through the same stages. And you get to the top, you get what you always wanted, then you don't know what to do with yourself.
Yeah.
And it's always depressing when you see a picture of the pop star that you like with Courtney Love's arm around the shoulder or Elton's arm or Bono's arm. They've fallen into that sort of stratosphere of tedium.
And that's because if you need a purpose, right, beyond wanting to be famous. And I'm not sure if I get from Jake Shears's memoir what he was trying. I mean, the sense that I get was that he couldn't do anything else and that he felt like himself the most when he was performing. But beyond that, what was the big sort of
idea? What do you make of
his
relationship with Mary, who he wrote the song about and who's featured in the book? She comes in and out.
She's the normal friend.
Yes.
She's the kind of grounded normal friend
help his narrative and say that he's not all Elton. He has this friend in, is she Arizona and then she moves to Seattle?
Yeah. Well, without wanting to give away spoilers, it's like she's the sort of touchstone of reality, isn't she? Mm. She's the person who's living in the real world, who increasingly, as the story goes on, it shows him what a cartoon his life has become and how meaningless it's become and how he's rattling around from event to event. I found it really poignant. But I think it's fair to say we're all heartily recommending this book, are we not?
Yes, absolutely.
I thought it was thoroughly enjoyable. Yeah. Yes. Okay, let's have some other music. Linda Marrick, we always ask our guests to bring in a tune for the edification of the listeners. What have you brought in for us?
A tune called Heavy, a kind of psychedelic shoegaze indie by a band called Gloria, who are from Lyon in France. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the girls is British. But it's a three boys who do the backing music and three girls on vocals. And it's absolutely beautiful song. I mean, I'll let you. It's on Ample Play,
which is
which is a label owned by Corner Shop, Tejinder Singh, and yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. I mean, I think it's on an EP as well. Which I can't actually remember.
Well, the listeners can Google up Heavy Gloria quite easily.
Anyway, check out Ample Play, and they have some really good tunes.
From the Stoke Newton Hit Factory Ample Play record. Ample Play, not Ample Ply, that's toilet Ample paper. Play. Ample Play. This is Heavy by Gloria.
Heavy by Gloria, as chosen by our guest Linda Marrick. Next up, let's go to the movies for Unsane, Steven Soderbergh's new horror movie shot entirely on an iPhone, starring Claire Foy as a woman who believes she's the victim of a stalker. But is it really happening? Is she being gaslighted, or is she gaslighting herself? What happens when you're not sure if you can trust your own mind, man? Does Unsane cut the mustard? Can we recommend it for a calming night out? I'm not sure about that. We'll find out after this excerpt.
Your life slips away from you, you know? Changing your phone number and your email becomes normal. Taking out a restraining order, normal. Relocating to another city, normal.
But you still see your stalker everywhere?
Rationally, I know this is my imagination, but I'm alone in a strange city and I never feel safe.
There's some more forms you need to fill out. It's just routine.
I finished my homework.
Sawyer Valentini, please follow me.
Well, look, I don't have a lot of time. I should be back at work, so. What am I doing in here?
Take off your clothes down to your underwear.
I'm not sure what's happening here. The door's locked.
It would be better for everyone, especially yourself, if you just do as I ask.
There's been some kind of mistake.
By signing this, you've consented to voluntary commitment.
I am being held here against my will.
Do you know how many calls the cops get like that every week?
Those are from crazy people. He's here.
Or maybe it's all in my head.
A bit of Unsane there, directed by Steven Soderbergh, starring Claire Foy, her from The Crown. Kate, can you set the film up for us? What's happening with Foy's character, who's called elegantly Sawyer Valentini?
I love that you've asked me to elegantly set this up, because the first thing I've put in my notes is...
Good recommendation for a horror film. That looked good on the poster, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Kate Hutchinson from The Guardian. Yeah, we're watching this film. Claire Foy's character, she's just started a new job. She's got a really unflattering ponytail and very grey kind of 90s style clothes on. Like she's a sort
a
of fringe
woman,
extra.
She's an office girl. Yeah.
It definitely has a look to it what I'm getting at. And she's sort of trying to settle in. She's speaking to her mum on the phone. There's something not quite right. She's lying to her mother really about having a lovely time. But we get the sense she's trying to start a new life. So she has a bit of a mental health wobble, Googles what to do, finds this local facility, turns up, and we think she's having a consultation about what to do if you feel depressed or if you feel blue. And she says kind of the wrong thing. And in any other situation, perhaps you would be like, oh yeah, well that's fine. She'll go and talk to someone. Mm. She'll make an appointment for 2 weeks. And then it all starts unravelling.
She accidentally gets herself committed.
She gets stuck there.
She signs herself away, doesn't she, without realising.
Yeah, sure. And for the sort of first sort of beginning of the film, this gaslighting thing comes into play. You're not quite sure whether to believe her. You're not sure whether to believe that she's had this stalker. You're not sure whether she is to be trusted. Mm. And then it sort of plays with your... Andrew, you're about to say something.
Well, I was going to say, it's hard to discuss this without getting spoiler crazy.
Yeah,
but
the core
of it is that she believes she's being stalked, and then things happen within the mental hospital that you are not sure if they're an artifact of her mental problems or drugs or if it's really happening.
Yeah. I mean, there's a deliberate ambiguity there, you know, that so you don't know. I mean, it's a typical kind of almost like 90s thriller, like...
It's slightly single white female, except only with one.
Exactly.
It's only one single white female.
Single white female. And, and I just I personally, I read it as a pastiche of those films, and I think it's quite funny as well in parts. And
I wasn't laughing.
Oh no, I laughed. I mean, I laughed so much laughing, in parts because I just thought it was. I saw it for what it was. I believe Soderbergh didn't make. I don't think it's to be taken seriously. I think lots of it was quite comical, just like, oh, for God's sake, you know. Yeah. But I it is a pastiche, definitely, well, in my opinion. Yeah.
The really kind of the sort of incendiary thing about it is it's talking about stalking, you know, which is something that's very much in the conversation at the moment. You know, male power over women. It's also talking about mental health equally. You know, it's got the serving of two hot potatoes. And
a double potato.
Yes, in the context of a stalker, scare-laden horror movie. And I suppose there's a valid criticism of is this some exceedingly serious subjects and turning them into a kind of pulpy, trite entertainment. What would you say to that?
I have no problem with that, in all honesty. I think we need to sort of take a step back and think, I mean, are we still allowed to have horror as entertainment or thriller as entertainment? And it's fine. I think it's perfectly fine. I think it's not, you know, very sort of politically sound at the moment to be making
it's politically engaged. Yeah, so it doesn't make fun of those subjects.
But at the same time, I think it's entertaining, engaging, very silly in parts, and I bought it completely. And I mean, it's also let's mention that it is filmed on an iPhone,
yes,
from start to finish.
Yeah. Yeah.
And after a while, you just forget about that. You forget that it's filmed on an iPhone. It's like there's lots of kind of like a fisheye. So did you not forget?
I didn't know that it was filmed on an iPhone when I watched it.
Okay.
And I was kind of wondering about the style of it. You know, this very kind of lo-fi sort of. Sort of style, but it did have the desired effect. It's funny that you found it silly. You enjoyed it as a pastiche.
Yeah.
I was terrified throughout the whole thing. I really I love hate those films that make you feel like you're suffocated and that you're closed in and that there's no escape. And I love that it was able to have that effect on me, but it wasn't an enjoyable watch. No. It wasn't for me.
I think, Andrew, you were the person who said to Kate and I, sorry for making you see this, sorry, as soon as the credits rolled. Well, whereas I loved it. I really loved it. I liked going there.
Which surprised
me. Frightened.
I mean, I think it's a really impressive filmmaking achievement. I didn't find it enjoyable at all.
Because
identification with, I mean, what the real horror in it is powerlessness. You are completely identified with Claire Foy, who has managed to place herself in somewhere where she has absolutely no control over what's happening to her.
Yeah.
And that's the really suffocating thing. She is brutalised in this film. And, you know, I'm not a horror fan. I don't enjoy movies where people are brutalised, particularly in the kind of context.
She is brutalised, but she also gives as much as she gets. She's not a victim. That's what I liked about the film. She basically goes around punching people, kicking them in the balls.
She's in a padded cell, and she manages to find a weapon.
That's what I loved about her character.
That's kind of powerless kicking out.
Yeah.
She's still for a good, and not to get into spoilers, but for the bulk of this movie, she's completely powerless.
Yeah.
It's not pleasant. It's also made me deeply suspicious of men that wear 80s frames. Why is it in films stalkers always have those same aviator-style glasses?
Yeah.
Always. Deeply suspicious.
The Terry Richardson glass
a symbol of not being in the real world, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of being in your little coop.
Do we think it's a fun night out? Is this an entertaining cinema experience? Because
would you take a date to this?
Absolutely, 100%. Like, seriously.
Yeah. You're a braver woman than I am.
I am. I've seen a lot worse, trust me. I really bought into it. I love Soderbergh. I'm a massive fan. I must say that I am a huge, huge fan of Soderbergh. And I think he's had some hits and misses, but I think this is really well done, and I bought completely into it, and I don't see what's wrong with it.
I thought was really good about Unsane is that it takes those two themes of approaches to mental health and stalking, and it's got something to say about them, and it manages to say within the framework of a pulp horror movie, but I can't say I enjoyed it. It freaked me out.
Okay.
I'm with you.
Okay, let's move right back to music. I think we better had quickly, hadn't we? Kate Hutchinson, it's your turn to bring in a tune. What have you brought in?
Aha! This is by a wonderful new artist called Nakane, which I only learnt how to pronounce yesterday when I saw him live. So I saw him live on stage and I was like, that's how you say it. Nakane, he's from South Africa. He is an actor and a musician that's really kind of leading the charge for LGBTQI people in South Africa. He's from the Xhosa community, which, if I believe correctly, it's for his grew up in New Brighton. So he's from a sort of community in South Africa that has a lot of sort of ancestral tribal rituals. And a lot of his music is about the conflict between that, his kind of very traditional upbringing and his Christian upbringing with being a young queer black man. And this track, Presbyterian, deals with a lot of those issues. It's just come out on his new album, which is, I think, came out this week, last week. I saw him perform live last night. He was haunting and magical and beautiful for fans of Moses Sumney and Depeche Mode and what else? He had quite a lot of lovely African sort of high lifestyle guitar in there as well. His music is very, you know, it's very moving and somber and it has a lot of poise and elegance.
Okay, well, here is the beautiful, somber, elegant Nakane. Did I say that right? Nakane.
Nakane.
Nakane with Presbyterian. Nakane with Presbyterian, as chosen by Kate Hutchinson. Okay then, come with us on a journey back to the great days of Britpop. The answer to Blur or Oasis is of course Pulp, the best, smartest and most perceptive band of the day. Common People and the Different Class albums were the ones that broke them, but it's now 20 years since the follow-up This Is Hardcore came out. It is considered to be the Britpop comedown album, received with bafflement at the time. It was grim and paranoid and seedy, and Pulp were never quite the same again. But what do we think of it now? We're going to talk it over after the title track, This Is Hardcore. Pulp and the queasy pornographic sounds of This Is Hardcore, 20 years old this week. Oh God, it brings it all flooding back. Now, Sean Pattenden, you were a Pulp person.
I was a member of the Pulp people, yeah.
I was
the
also
so-called fan club, yeah.
I was also a member of the Pulp people.
Yeah,
I got sent a square of Jarvis's trousers.
Oh, I've still got it somewhere, yeah. The square of Jarvis's trousers. That was before fame,
before
when he was happy. This is after fame, isn't it, Andrew?
It is.
So after tell us, fame's not good.
How did you receive This Is Hardcore? Because it was quite the change of gears, wasn't it?
It's a very difficult album. I think it's difficult to listen to now. This is someone just saying everything went really, really wrong.
Yeah.
He seems to... It's very pervy. It's all about porn. It's all about him not being happy with himself. It's quite lewd. It's quite rude. The music isn't Common People. It isn't Misfits. I find it quite difficult to listen to then and now. I mean, I don't know. I think it's, you know, it bombed, didn't it, really?
Well, it's sort of it wasn't the sorrowy pop success that previous things had been. Linda, what was it? Were you a Pulp?
I was, I was a Pulp. I mean, I wasn't a fan of This Is Hardcore, I must say. And I think pretty much apart from This Is Hardcore, Help the Aged, this is the only other single that I remember from it. That was released as a single, wasn't it?
Help the Aged,
it was.
That was the preceding single.
Yeah, and as you said earlier, it is a come down album, really. It was from like euphoria to complete utter depression. And I'm not entirely sure why it was released.
Well, I mean, there was an awful lot riding on Pulp in those days. I mean, they were at least as big as Blur had been at that time. Yeah. And you know, there were, you know, as we all know, there were loads of fantastic classics that they came out with. I mean, listening to it again, I was actually surprised at how clever and entertaining and self-deprecating and humorous it was. Mm. I think at the time, we were all absolutely shocked. But you listen to it now, and it begins with The Fear, which is this I'm living a nightmare, and then goes straight into Jarvis doing the dishes in his flat. Kate?
When did Blur release their Come Down album? Well, I'm struggling to remember.
It was the breakup album, wasn't it?
Well, that was probably Blur or 13, wasn't it?
The Beatles bum album. So Pulp got in there first,
I
like. Mm. I was 11 when this came out, guys.
So you're ideally placed.
Yes, exactly. So I Common People was one of the first tapes that I had. And as a young girl, you know, Britpop really came to me through, it was pop by then. I wasn't, there at the beginning or anything. Mm. So I really loved all the upbeat stuff. And then Help the Aged came out, and I remember distinctly feeling, what is this? I mean, 11-year-old, 12-year-old, I was, I didn't want this kind of music. I wanted upbeat fun. I think then I just very quickly went into UK garage and R&B at that time. But listening back to it now, I appreciate what it was trying to do. I like that they were always taking, they were taking left turns like this, that they were like, hey, we know that you want a really kind of technicolor, mini skirted, bobbed rye pop album, but we're just going to give you something gnarly and grim.
I think the interesting thing about it is that Blur kind of, there was inevitably going to be a mighty crash after the ludicrous success of Britpop. And there's actually the closing track on This Is Hardcore, The Day After the Revolution, is kind of about that. Mm. But Blur sidestepped it by sort of turning themselves into a Pavement style, American influenced band and sort of pretended it had been nothing to do with them. Oasis just ploughed on with the disastrous Be Here Now and became the parody that was being talked about. And only Pulp and Jarvis had the guts to actually look at it and say, this is what we've done. This is what it's done to us. Is it a good thing? Mm. They'd had a longer run in than anyone because, the thing that everybody forgets about Pulp is that for 14 years, they did nothing whatsoever. They were a standing joke, the life on the dole. And then this band that's been doing nothing forever finally becomes big. Mm. And in a way, we're talking about Jake Shears and his kind of inability to deal with success. I mean, this is the kind of record you should probably make after you've had the success that's changed you, where you look at it and you're pretty kind of unforgiving of yourself.
Mm. Yeah. There was a time when Jarvis, and he said that in interviews at the time, just went out all the time and he was in the tabloids all the time. And I remember that there was an Action Man party. Someone had held an Action Man party for this and Jarvis was there. And I think that was the point we just think, okay, things have got to change. And he's mentioned that before, that it just got too much. At least he's really honest about it. This is a really honest album. I admire it for all of those sorts of things, but it isn't a happy listen. Don't sort of walk away. You don't whistle the tunes.
You know what, though? Listening to it again, I was surprised at how much happier it was than I remember. Right. All these songs are on my phone, so they pop up now and again. Mm. Every few days, a Pulp song will pop up. And when you look at it, there's like... The massive downers of The Fear and Dishes, which is like a lament for what a waste his life has become, and TV Movie, which is kind of it's like the polar opposite of Something Changed. Mm. Something Changes, love arrives and everything's beautiful. Yeah. And this is love goes away and everything's awful. My life has become a hangover without end. And that's the first line, then the song is even more depressing. But alongside it, you've got things like, Party Hard, which is basically Pulp doing Scary Monsters, or even Pulp doing Never Let Me Down, that really garish, coked up Bowie thing about having to be out every single night.
Aside from the music being clearly still great and standing up, what this did make me think about was the idea of this career-ending album. I mean, this is how people talk about This Is Hardcore, right? That Pulp were really never the same again. But that doesn't really seem to exist as a concept anymore. When was the last time you heard in recent years a career-ending album? I feel like people's personal brands are stronger now. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Well, this was when Jarvis was... I mean, they did make further records. They made We Love Life with Scott Walker, which is a strange, deliberate attempt to be small and sort of bucolic and, to get it together in the countryside, man. But this was their last big thing that I had to say. And I actually think it's quite an elegant and honourable way of going, we don't want to do this anymore, but we are at least going to look at it and show you why we don't want to do it.
And also because they were still big. What made me laugh was Radio 1 having to have them as an A-list on their... you know, playing them, and people were phoning radio and going, "Why are you playing this? It's not
stop playing
good.
Help the Aged.
Stop playing Help the Aged." I actually remember it really well. People like literally complaining, "Why do you?" But obviously, because they'd been told this is one of the biggest bands in the country, and they still have to play them.
They were still headlining festivals. Yeah, they were still headlining. You know, and they're still big.
Yeah, and to be fair, I still think Help the Aged is a brilliant and a very funny and a very perceptive song about what it's like when you're no longer, because Jarvis. He had a long apprenticeship. He didn't start at the age of 21 as a pop star. He was older and therefore more experienced. And this song is about, you know, what do you do when you're kind of still trying to hang on to your youth and you're not that person?
It's anymore. Like Late Flowering Lust by John Betjeman. Well, there's elements of that.
I tell you what he does now. Oh, sorry to interrupt, Sian.
It's a talk show. You can interrupt all you like.
Right. Well, I felt bad. I just needed to tell you all about his DJing. Mm. I DJed after him. Before him? Before him at the Dodgems at Dreamland in Margate. And he did like a whole kind of Dodgems themed DJ set with Beanie Man, Who Am I, and Grace Jones, Pull Up From
the
a Bunker. No, it was a couple of years before maybe. It was a Moshi Moshi event, I think, called By the Sea. But he's also doing a sort of run of DJ shows at the Moth Club in East London very soon, which I think is really cool because he's a massive name.
He always
and he's
used
doing
to play Axel F by Harold Faltermeyer. There which really made me laugh.
Well, John is a good good taste. And actually, he's much more comfortable being a sort of alternative-y person on the margins than he was being, you know, being shoved around from award ceremony to and being in the papers every
being
day.
Being the national treasure.
And became the Michael Jackson guy, you know. So, you know, I don't think he liked himself very much after that.
I sort of listening to this in comparison with Different Class, because, you know, Different Class is the fantastic album and it broke them and it's, you know, became the kind of generational thing the one that, you know, when people go, oh, Blur Oasis, no, really, it's Different Class. But actually listening to that next to This Is Hardcore, I think This Is Hardcore comes off better. I think there's something sort of a little bit kind of, wide-eyed and kind of, you know, sugar rushy about Different Classes. Really
self-conscious.
Appealing. Yeah. Well, actually, weirdly enough, This Is Hardcore is more self-conscious because he's looking at what they've done to themselves. Mm. You were talking about, like, Help the Aged being on the radio. Mm. The title track, This Is Hardcore, is like a six-and-a-half-minute seedy, slow cocktail jazz, you know, kind of soundscape about pornography and self-abuse where the vocals don't come in for 2.5 minutes.
Yeah, couldn't get away with
that
anymore.
It's a single, isn't it?
I mean, that is brave, really.
It's really brave, stands up. I also like the fact that there is an arc to this record and it does finish optimistically. It does finish with, we've done it and we're free now.
I would also just like to jump in and say that such a Pulp fan am I that I said I think my favourite album was Common People that I had on tape. I meant Different Class. Yeah. I meant, obviously, a huge Pulp fan over here in the corner.
I think it stands up really well in comparison to what we thought about it at the time. You going to be listening to it again, Sian?
I don't know. I think I'm going to do that annoying thing of pick selected tracks and some of the upbeat tracks and then put it on a playlist, actually. Yeah.
Mm. Well, there we go. Pulp's This Is Hardcore, 20 years old.
Finally, it's back. The Big Mouth Special, the album no one else likes but me. Almost everyone has an album that they love, but that's capable of clearing a room, or one that gets you banned from the office stereo, which has happened to me. Like every office stereo I get banned from. This week, we get to peer inside the dark hearts of our guests as they reveal an album they love, they genuinely love, but that's actually rubbish, I think, this week particularly. You're going to hear it. You're going to hear it. Let's hear a couple of tracks from The Choices.
There are too many questions. There is not one solution. There is no resurrection. There is so much confusion. And the love profusion. You make me feel, you make me know. And the love vibration. You make me feel, you make it shine. There are
it's the it's understood that Hollywood sells Californication.
That That was Madonna with Love Profusion from her underappreciated album, American Life, which Linda Marek still listens to.
Absolutely, 100%.
After all this time, yes. She still listens to this. Mm-hmm. Followed swiftly by the worst band in history, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, with the worst song ever, California, Californication, from the album of the same name, which Kate Hutchinson inexplicably loves. Right, we're going to have to start with someone, and it's going to be Linda. Madonna, American Life. The album. Why do you love it?
I think I loved it mostly because everyone else hated it. I mean, I've always been a massive Madonna fan anyway, and I've liked every single thing that she's released, even the most horrendous stuff, including the last, you know, whatever she's been releasing in the last couple of years. So I remember when American Life came out and she's in her sort of Che Guevara cap and, you know, doing everyone going, oh, we can see through you, you know, this is a this version of Madonna is ridiculous. And I kind of felt sorry because I just thought, you know, she's trying to do something different. It was, I think, the first time she picked up the guitar as well.
So what was she trying to do different?
I think she just didn't want to be seen as the frivolous pop star. She just, she wanted... It was a political album, and she also quite feminist, actually, if you think about it. And she just wanted people to see her as more than this pop artist, I think. That's what it was.
This album comes after Music and Ray of Light, which were really well received. Yeah, yeah. You know, they were lauded as Madonna albums. Yeah. And she drops, as I say, this one. It's got a lot of acoustic guitar on it.
Yeah, and it's I think it's also produced by Mel Wes.
Yes.
I think it's very techno-y as well.
Mm. Mel Wes produced music. The second one as well. Yeah. See, to me, this is like the first time that was like a kind of a chink in the armour, because previously she'd been so unstoppable.
Mm.
You know, all the covers, you know, all the covers of all the magazines, all the hits. Ray of Light and Music had been so brilliant and so all-conquering.
Yeah.
And this, to me, was when, you know, that thing of, you know, when a politician shows weakness, the wolves gather.
Yeah.
And there was just something where she showed that she perhaps wasn't still that sort of indomitable pop thing. And then you start to see all the faults.
Yeah, and I think her rhyming latte with butty didn't help either. So, you know, I think people just thought, oh, God, what are you doing? You know, this is ridiculous. But I kind of like, I think if you like someone, just stick with them, really. And you might not like this album, you might like the next one. I just bought into it. There are quite a few singles on it that I quite like.
Singles? I mean, she has the famous rap in.
Yes. In American Life.
Yes, yeah. About her driving her car and going to Pilates and having
Cooper.
Three nannies.
Yeah.
Are you relating to this? Because I think she was trying to be relatable, but the opposite effect happens when you say...
I think she was being self-deprecating rather than relatable.
Okay.
I think it was more
maybe you have a
It was like, oh, look, I might have all of this stuff, but I also...
She's Jenny from the block.
Exactly. I might have all of this stuff, but I am also me. I think it was self-deprecating. I think people take her a bit too literally sometimes. And I will die defending her honour and her right to be as awful as she wants to be, because she has done so much already. Mm. She doesn't need to prove herself.
Kate,
I'm ready for the roasting.
Here we go. So.
I'm deeply regretting this
after,
choice.
I mean, Madonna's going to feel light and fluffy and marshmallowy now. Kate, my dear God, woman.
Yeah. Here we go.
Your album is Californication by the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I have to say that slowly because it's really hard for me to speak those words. Why?
Well, I had to pick it because that was my gut reaction. That was
fulfills the brief.
And obviously, I've got such incredible music taste, you know, such well-seasoned taste buds that...
Curated.
You know, well-curated music taste that everything else, you know, is stuff that other people like. So when I really digged deep down to think of an album... that if I was on a road trip somewhere, let's say in California, sure, and this came on, I wouldn't turn it off. I would actually sing all the words to it because I know every single word on the album.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, they were quite disgusting as well, some of the words.
Some of them are, yeah.
I mean, I call it perv sock rock funk rock music.
Mm.
I can't even not think of those pervy socks when I think of Red Hot Chili Peppers now. Mm. It just doesn't, they don't go away from me. What is the lure for you then? You know all the words. What is this thing for you that makes me think that's dreadful and you want to put it on.
Sure. So I discovered this album because some boy that I fancied on Christian camp like gave it to me on tape or something. Yeah. And I was like, flick my hair. I was like, sure.
What did he give it to you with the words?
Just like,
take
really
this
cool,
bloody awful record off me, please.
Like, like this. Like, whatever. Like, yeah. I'm just going to get my skateboard, whatever, okay. Sure.
Can you please put this record in the bin for me?
Yeah. So, okay. Hang on. I'm going to get there. So, you know, at the time, what was I, 13, 14, alternative rock was booming again, new metal was, you know, everyone loved Linkin Park, Limp Bizkit, all of these things. This was pre my kind of feminist awakening via Riot Girl, I would say. So, okay. You know, there is a song, I think, about period sex on
yes,
Californication,
oh,
right? Right, sure. But for me, it had this kind of, I can't believe I'm saying this now, mystique about California. I thought, oh, it's all about sex, it's pervy, you know, it's got the funk, blah, blah, blah. And they were, at the time, one of the biggest bands. You know, I went to see them at London Arena. I was on the front row. There's a picture of me in a Kerrang that I have that's taken from the back of the stage. And you can see me on the front row, wow, dreamily looking up at John Frusciante, whose name I still can't say after all these years. So now looking back at Californication with all the things that I know and the feminist awakening that I've had, mm-hmm, and knowing that Anthony Kiedis, you know, only dates women that are under 20 years old.
I didn't know
I think... Oh, yeah. I mean, I actually had a quick Google this morning to make sure I wasn't saying anything untoward. Yeah, I think his last girlfriend was a 19-year-old model. Sure.
Right.
So when I look at it through that frame,
yeah,
I obviously, I feel quite icky. You know, much like that period song about velvet gloves and whatnot. Mm. But at
the
time... They're the
disgustings of rock.
But exactly. No, they are. And, you know, it's funny because I kind of picked this album also because I think it was Dorian Lynskey that said, you can always tell when someone's a wanker if you ask them if they like Red Hot Chili Peppers and they say yes. And, you know, I think it's just an age thing and a context thing. You know, I wasn't aware that they were a band. You know, I just used to go around my friend's house and watch MTV2 and be like, oh, this is so cool. I want to be in California, you know, funking out with Flea.
It certainly isn't music that was made in Scunthorpe, was it? It's not music that's made in Paris. It sounds like it was made in California. It's there. It keeps mentioning California.
I would love to hear some slap-based funk music made in Scunthorpe because I think it would be more interesting than this.
I think actually there was quite a lot of it around. But also in Basingstoke, where I grew up, there was a lot of bands that wanted to be the kind of the midpoint between Red Hot Chili Peppers and Faith No More. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. The massive, huge spread of Red Hot Chili Peppers and Faith No More. It's like, if you got a long way round, I suppose, there's quite a lot, you know, in between the two.
It was a musically rich town.
Yeah. Well, that you're saying, Dorian saying it's an identifier of certain kind of people. There's a sort of apocryphal quote from Nick Cave knocking about where he said, you know, like when you go into like a cafe or something and there's always some god awful music playing, it's some horrible bloke yelping on about his penis and how funky he is, and it's always a Red Hot bloody Chili Peppers.
Yes,
that sort of seems to be the.
But generationally, not to keep bringing up age, but I do think that this album is, you know, very much of its time, and it captured a whole young generation of, you know, of teenagers, of grebos, of people who consider themselves alternative. You know,
I was
a
teenage grebo. Yes.
Exactly, and
yes.
I know, for example, I think myself and Eve Barlow might be the Janice D. Barlow might be the only other person that I know that really that gets that, that knows that this album meant something alternative when you were younger.
So let's just get this straight, right? It's not okay to have a go at Madonna for being old. But it's okay to have a go at us for not liking the Red Hot Chili Peppers because we're old. Let's get this straight,
no,
shall we?
No, I'm just
Hutchinson.
Saying that you guys had more developed musical
speak
tastes.
Speak up.
Yeah, you guys had more musical developed musical tastes at that point. Whereas I just got a tape from a hot boy at Christian camp and was like, wicked, this feels punky and funky and different.
But I think you've got a point. You are almost persuading me here, which I think is quite interesting. It's the point when you're young. And when something is really popular, and this isn't a bad album in the sense that the verses are in the right places, the chorus, it's Rick Rubin, it's a pop album. Mm. When you're young and you see something when you're 12, 13, and it's really, really popular, and they're doing it quite well, and that idea, wow, you could reach this amount of people, you could do this song, you could be on stage whether you've got a sock on your penis or not. This could have, there's something about the lure of that when you're young, before you get into, oh, I like music no one else has ever heard of and it's not really great. and I get that kind of young, fresh, wow, life is actually quite exciting.
Totally.
Listening to this, I hated it, but I can imagine it, someone feeling that that's fresh and exciting in the sound of now.
What I'm interested in is the idea of revisiting the albums that meant something to you when you were younger, and seeing whether you can go, yes, definitely this is shite. You know, like, whether you can really separate nostalgia from whether something's genuinely good. And, you know, and that's what I'm really interested in. Yeah. Like, what are the albums when you go back to where you think, why, like, that is terrible. What was I thinking?
Visage. I had that with that Visage album I used to listen to. Morrissey's.
Oh, yeah.
That everyone hated at the time. And I just made myself learn every single lyric. And I just made myself love it.
Yes.
But then.
There's loads of good stuff on Malajustin.
It's not a great album, put it this way. I mean, there are a couple of good tunes. But at the time, I thought it was brilliant. Because, you know, we were just thirsty for any
Morrissey.
As I say,
you just want to hear pop music, don't you? You want to hear something sometimes.
Well. I don't think you've persuaded me of Red Hot Chili Peppers, certainly. American Life, possibly, I don't know. I think it's a bit of a push. I don't know about you, Stan. Are you going to be going revising
American Life, never again. I listened to that on the Overground.
Sorry.
I apologise.
Well, time is ticking down. We're almost at the end of the show, which means it's time for closing time chatter. What will our friends be discussing as they try to prevent overzealous bar persons from snatching the last of that blue Hawaiian out of their hands at 10:59 p.m. this weekend? Linda Marek, I believe you've got a thing about Tomb Raider.
Oh, yes, I do, yeah. Basically, my point is mostly the need for more female film critics to counterbalance all the garbage that's been written. But the newest Tomb Raider film, I mean, it's not the best film of the year. I think if you go and watch a Tomb Raider movie, you know exactly what you're getting. But some of the reviews have been absolutely... I mean, I just can't believe what... I mean, there's this guy from the Philly Voice... called Jerome Maida. So I'm going to read you just a little thing of what he said. Vikander, this is because Alicia Vikander is basically the Angelina Jolie's character. So Vikander's appearance is also markedly different than Jolie, than Jolie's. She never comes across as having an ounce of sex appeal and at times looks like she could be 16. Tossing the lack of... curves, and Warner Brothers could have decided to gender bend and make a film titled Luke Croft, and it would have come across the same way.
So basically, the objective is she's not sexy enough.
Well, for my liking, says A-man.
For his liking.
Yeah.
I think she's the best thing about the film.
Yeah.
Mm. I think it's a good thing that
so
she
So you're saying more female film critics are stopping
this? I think there should... All these national newspapers and local papers should employ more. Women go to the cinema as well. We just need the other side. You know, I don't want just someone who sitting at home, you know, fantasizing about Angelina Jolie from 20 years ago.
But what if a woman had written she's not curvy enough?
I do not believe a woman would have written that, in all honesty. I have not met a single female critic. And it's actually quite annoying. I mean, if I ask you now to tell me who is the most famous female critic, film critic in the UK... maybe you might be able to say one name, but all of us can say this, that person. This is not, I'm not saying the main film critics that are in The Guardian or The Observer or anywhere else are not good, because they're brilliant and they're friends of mine who I know very well, who are brilliant writers and write very intelligently. What we need is more high-profile female critics.
Yeah, where's the female Mark Kermode?
Exactly. Mm. I mean, there's Wendy Ides who writes for The Observer, but if you ask the person in the street, they're not going to tell you who she is. They don't know who she is.
I'm just intrigued by this guy saying, you know, imagine if there was a male Lara Croft. Has he not seen Raiders of the Lost Ark? Is he not aware of Indiana Jones?
Funny you should say that, because the new film is very much that. It's very much that.
Kate Hutchinson, your closing time chatter.
My closing time chatter is more like a closing time musing that might be a bit half-formed. Mm-hmm. But anyway, this week in The Guardian, a writer called Thea de Gallia wrote a piece about whether Me Too and the movement will kill off the rock and roll groupie, which had lots of input from famous quote-unquote groupies like Laurie Maddox, and Pamela DeBar. And, I mean, it's something that I think about a lot, about this idea of whether... you know, rock and roll or musicians' behaviour is being sanitised or something, or whether, you know, how that might affect music in the future, and all these kind of different issues. And I think it's obviously a very complex, nuanced issue. And
I wonder how we kind of hold men's behaviour to account and challenge those power structures that exist between male musicians and female, quote unquote, groupies or fans or whatever, without making young girls feel like their fantasies or their sexuality or whatever is invalid or wrong or bad. Mm. But what really struck me is at the end of the article, there was an anonymous musician that said, when I meet fans now, the conversation isn't, I really love your band. It's, please don't do anything wrong.
God.
Oh, what a depressing thought.
Yeah.
That is
awful.
And it just makes me think about the idea that we have to hold, or should we be holding, our artists or our favourite musicians to account in that way. Taking, obviously, with sexual misconduct, that is a very serious issue. But in terms of, you know, general bad behaviour, you know, what where's the line going to be drawn in the future?
Well, particularly, let's say, you know, music, rock and roll is built on sex, it's built on sex appeal. You know, the sex appeal of male and female stars and the kind of channeling of, I mean, it goes back to, you know, Fred and Judy Vermeil's Starlust stuff about the fact that pop was for decades the channel through which teenage sexuality was sense, and it built an entire industry was built around it. And if we take that out completely, then what kind of what is left of this sort of field of dreams that stardom is?
But I don't think that, you know, I think it's about allure, isn't it? And it's about mystique. And I think once musicians cross that line and, you know, there are assault cases or there is sexual misconduct, you know, it's like you can still be a musician that upholds these kind of the mystique, the allure of rock and roll, whatever that means to you, without having to cross that line, without abusing your power, without... So I suppose that's really what I'm getting at, is that I think perhaps it's this allure or the kind of mystique or the illusion of rock and roll has been broken down.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Stan?
Mine isn't half as controversial. I was just going to ask everyone else, has everyone else got a headphones hoarding problem?
Headphones hoarding,
I keep buying them. I've got different ones for different situations. So I've got one where I can skip the tracks if I know I've got to listen to something I don't really want to listen to, and that's for the tube. I've got one that I can go to the gym with that's Bluetooth, so don't fall over the cable, because I do that on all the time on the treadmill. I've got one that's my fancy pair, so I don't take them out very much, and they were quite expensive for me, although the man in the shops told me that the far more expensive versions I could be getting. They're really nice, and so they get put in the proper place. Then there's one that's the old pair that kind of, that they're falling apart, but I like them because the bass is very good. Then I've got three earphone sets and I need to buy more. Is this a problem? Who do I need to see?
Yes, you're, you are hoarders.
You're the problem. Yeah, yeah. You are the landfill problem.
I still don't think I've got enough. And I'm starting buying mini speakers as well for the house as well. I mean, there's everywhere. I've got about five sets of speakers.
I've minimised it. I have one pair, Etymotic E10s.
Ooh,
that's all you need.
That sounds like a disease. And a headphone.
It's like all you need. They're brilliant and they cost about 30 quid.
Right.
It's good sound.
But do you trip up over
the treadmill? I've got a pair of wireless Sonys that cost me 20 quid.
Oh, God, no, I have got a problem. Yeah, okay.
I just use this rubbish, you know, Apple... iPhone ones.
I get really obsessed.
I don't use those at all.
I get really obsessed about whether you can hear hi-hatty or bassy or those sorts of things and the stereo and things like that. That's a madness, isn't it?
I think it's fine
if you're a music journalist, which you are. So I think it's okay.
Well, my closing time chatter is a quick one. We mentioned a friend of the show, Dorian Linsky, earlier on. He's writing a book about George Orwell, and he found this incredible quote in his research about one of my areas of interest. Orwell said, who, without misgivings, would bring up a child on the coloured comics in which sinister professors manufacture atomic bombs in underground laboratories while Superman whizzes through the clouds, the machine gun bullets bouncing off his chest like peas, and platinum blondes are raped, or very nearly, by steel robots and 50-foot dinosaurs? Now, apart from the obviously problematic bit in there, that sounds like a great setup for me. I was brought up on that and it hadn't done me any harm. Scientists below ground, 50-foot dinosaurs, atomic bombs. And everybody I know was brought up on this and it hasn't done them any harm either. So, you know, I'm ride or die for George Orwell. But he doesn't know what he's talking about on the comic book front. And maybe he should have been introduced to this at an early age. And maybe it would have maybe a little bit less less judgmental about people who don't follow his own ideas. As listener Terry Jeffrey pointed out, Orwell would have been banging to Charlie's War and Judge Dredd. So perhaps, you know, the time wasn't right for him.
When did he say that then?
I don't know. Dorian found it in a quote of Orwell's writings. Not sure whether Orwell would have been so keen on V for Vendetta, but never mind. Anyway, that's the end of the show. Thanks to our guests, Kate Hutchinson and Linda Marek. Thanks to my wing person, Sean Pattenden, and thanks to producer Sophie Black. Remember, you can hear all of our past episodes at audioboom.com/bigmouth. And if you want to support the show, and who wouldn't, you can buy us a pint via patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast. What could be better? Thank you all for listening. We're going to see you again next week. Bye.
Bye.